Good evening, folks. I'm starting this off just a little bit different. I want to give you a teaser about what we're going to talk about tonight. H. Edward Tickell Jr. He was once considered the FBI's foremost expert in secret break-ins. He was the ultimate bagman or black bag expert for the FBI. They had a term for the people that would break in and install hidden microphones and cameras and things like that. They called them bagmen, and it was a black bag job. Or just a bag job. In 1980, Mr. Edward Tickell, at that time former FBI agent, was sentenced in federal court in Alexandria, Virginia, to 8 years in prison for transporting stolen diamonds, obstruction of justice, tax evasion, and two other charges.
You put $50,000 in cash money in the spot.
$300 Quaker, probably in the spot.
They steal the store, they turn it into cash.
Okay, I'm on their northbound access. Trying to lie.
Look, can I be, Carl, what the hell can be done? And I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, everybody. It's good to be back here in the deep, dark confines of Studio 4 in the beautiful Ice House in Midtown Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
You know, Aaron and I had quite a week this last week. We, of course, this won't be the week before this podcast appears, but I just need to tell you about it. If you remember, we did a two-part series on a skyjacking in 1972. It was a skyjacker who copied off of D.B. Cooper. He parachuted out with $500,000.
Wasn't it $502,400?
Exactly, $502,400. We found out why he wanted the extra $2,400.
Small bills.
Small bills. And those were small bills. The others were larger bills. So we spent almost, I think we spent about 6 hours, and then we had dinner with Mr. Martin McNally. He had heard the podcast, and he thought it was so funny, and he liked what we did, but we had some facts wrong, which was probably rightfully so. I probably get a fact wrong. I always say, never let the facts get in the way of a good story. And so he replied on my Facebook page, not on my Facebook. He replied on my webpage that has the podcast up on it underneath the podcast. If you want to read those replies, you can go to that particular page and look in the comments section. And so I emailed him and I said, we'd like to interview. And I said, well, how about a telephone interview? Because he was not that far away. He's not in Kansas City, but he's not that far away. He kind of wants to keep his location. I guess I can say he's in St. Louis. St. Louis is a pretty good-sized city. He emailed back, and he said, well, why don't you just come down? We went down. We took three cameras and two recorders. We spent the whole day recording him.
Four microphones, just in case.
And four microphones, yeah. We spent the whole day with Mr. Martin McNally, and it was really interesting. And, he's a good guy. I really enjoyed my time with him, and he was a lot of fun. He did commit the crime back then, and
that's a great story.
It's a great story, and there's more to that story. So we've got that one. I've just got to get set down and edit that thing, and that is coming up sometime over the summer. It would be probably maybe somewhere between 4 and 7 episode session. I'm not sure how it's going to break down. We tried to break it down. We like to keep these around 30 minutes because I understand an awful lot of commutes are at 30 minutes. Or I know I listen to podcasts and I put on the 30-minute.
You can fall asleep in 30 minutes listening to a podcast.
Yes, I can. I put on the 30-minute
timer.
Timer. Thank you, Aaron. I couldn't think of the word. The 30-minute timer, and usually I'm asleep about the time it's over. So, I don't know. It just works for me, and I hope it works for you.
Well, you're not talking about our podcast here. But other podcasts.
No, I never fall asleep on our podcast. Actually, when I listen to ours, I usually listen to it in the car. It's pretty hard to listen to myself. Sometimes I know the story so well, but if I listen to it in the car, I can listen to it critically for some reason. That's one reason I've kind of changed this opening because I want to put a teaser in. I realize that sometimes maybe you kind of know what it's going to be about, but it takes us a long time to get to it because we have all these other things. We start chatting back and forth. And so I thought I'm going to let you know what it's about. It's worth sticking around for, folks, as you listen to all our crap. Anyhow.
Well, but when we recorded all this, when we spent the day, you picked me up at 5:30 in the morning.
Yes, I did.
We hit the road. We stopped here at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4 for a moment and grabbed a couple extra things. They're already packed up. And 4 hours to get there, another hour of setting up, and almost six and a half hours of just recording. And we did it the way we would do the episodes, like we're doing them right now, where you'd play a bumper, although we didn't tease it and then play the bumper. We'd play a bumper, and Gary would lead us in and say hello, Aaron, and introduce Martin, and then we kind of go in, and then we broke the story down kind of through the arc of the story.
Right, and kind of chronological, you know, hour by hour, actually, because this guy had a great memory, and he remembered all kinds of details. We found out a lot about him before, which we didn't know about his life before the incident.
And we found out about the genesis of what, you know, sparked the idea, and you'll have to listen to the episodes to hear that, but you'll hear it from the mouth of the man who did it, which
you will.
I think is one of the monikers of the Gangland Wire Crime Stories.
That's what we try to get it from the mouths of the people that did it. We can't always get it done.
Sometimes it's police officers.
Right.
Infrequently, it's criminals.
I've got a couple of cops lined up to do the Richard Grissom story. It's a horrible murder story. Anyhow, so we did that. Right now, I'm working on my Kindle interactive book about the 1978 Las Vegas skim investigation, which the movie Casino was based on. I've talked about this before. I'm using dialogue from the wiretap transcripts, and Kindle book users with an internet connection will be able to click on a link inside the book, and then we'll take them to another website, and you'll be able to listen with titles, with captions to the actual audio of the men who stole the money and schemed and planned to steal more money from the Las Vegas casinos and had their little internal strifes and fights. These people are the real life Ace Rothstein, who was played by Robert De Niro, the Lefty Rosenthal, and Nicky Santoro, Tony Spilotro, was played by Joe Pesci, and Philip Green was played by somebody that I don't know. Actually, he was more of a minor actor. That was Stardust owner Alan Glick. And John Nance was the character's name, was actually Carl Thomas. He was a skimming expert. He'd been skimming from casinos from his start of his career, and everybody thought he was Mr. Clean in Las Vegas until they got caught on these wiretaps. John Nance, if you remember, he was a guy with the white hair that would go in and set up the collection of the money. He would make excuses for, like, he made the excuses that, well, these guys, they got to steal a little themselves. As a matter of fact, not too long ago, I just went through this whole thing. Nick Savella called a moratorium on skimming from the Tropicana because he was afraid the people who were skimming his money were skimming money from him. Artie Pisciano was the Tuffy DeLuna character. He was the guy who started complaining in the back of the, or out in the restaurant, not in the restaurant, in the little corner store, the grocery store. A lot of people like to say, oh, they know where that grocery store is. Well, that bug, there was a bug in his place, and it was Tuffy DeLuna complaining about going to Las Vegas and straightening people out in Las Vegas. But it was in the back of the Villa Capri, and I've got clips from that wiretap. And then Alan King played Alan Dorfman, and we've got him in it, and Nick Savella was the name in the movie was Vincent Borelli. He was the guy who told Tuffy DeLuna not to keep records, and Tuffy wrote everything down, and we got that in the search warrant. So that's going right now. I'm almost.
You said you're down to the last chapter.
The rough draft. But I do have all the little videos made of all the wiretaps. Also, that's a huge amount of work there. Once you play that file labeled EX, that's for exhibit. All these different things were marked exhibit. Exhibit 185, Lefty Cute Remark. This is an excerpt from a wiretap on a public phone at the Breckenridge Inn, which is a hotel here in Kansas City. It's located on the east side in an industrial area right off of I-435.
Is that in your Kansas City Mob Tour app?
I can't remember. May or may not be. I'd have to look and
you
see.
You might have to add that.
I may have to. I've got the other big meeting in that, and where they had the bug at at the Villa Capri, the Marlowe House up at the App. I may not have the a little story about the Breckenridge Inn, why that's important. That'll be a good addition to that. Anyhow, it's a conversation between who we'd call Mr. Inside at the Tropicana, a man named Joe Augusto, who was a guy from Sicily, claimed he was born in the United States, and he went back to Sicily as a young man, was raised there. I think, in fact, he had gotten somebody else's birth certificate, and he probably was actually a Sicilian or Italian citizen. And Kansas City underboss, Carl Tuffy DeLuna. And when you listen to this, at this point in time, Tuffy has already gone out to Las Vegas and ordered Alan Glick to make a public announcement that he's going to sell the Stardust Casino. Glick had made this announcement, and boss of Kansas City, Nick Savella, and his underboss, Tuffy, had approved Augusto to put together a syndicate of clean investors out there in Las Vegas. They were some of the people that were part owners of the Tropicana, and he had their confidence, and he knew he could manipulate his way around them and keep skim going out of whatever casino they own. And he had put together this syndicate to purchase the Stardust. Lefty Rosenthal was Mr. Inside over at the Stardust at this point in time, and he's not controlled by the Kansas City crime family.
He was controlled by Chicago, wasn't he?
He was controlled by the Chicago outfit. And Lefty was in huge trouble with the Nevada Gaming Control Board. And any change in ownership at the Stardust would probably result in Lefty being fired. He was hanging on by a thread right then. And Lefty was putting together his own group to buy the Stardust that would be controlled by him and by the Chicago outfit. And that would keep the skim going straight to Chicago. Now, Chicago was sharing with Kansas City. But Kansas City wanted control of the skim. They would have shared with Chicago and Milwaukee and Cleveland, just like it always been, but they wanted control of it because that probably meant that gave them more power. It's not really sometimes so much about the money. They would have gotten more money, but it would have given them more power also out in Las Vegas. On this clip, Augusto reports to Tuffy that Lefty claims his group, meaning the Chicago outfit, has a Kansas City outmatched in this contest to buy the Stardust Casino. Go ahead, play that, Aaron.
So, on a cute remark he made, whatever you're doing, I want you to know, we got you outmatched.
We got you outmatched. Except the word to use.
And whatever you do, it ain't going to work.
I don't know what he got in mind, but believe me, we got you outmatched. I don't know. Maybe you don't think I don't know, but still, I believe me, we got you outmatched, you know? Okay. And whatever you do is not going to work.
All right. Did he make any mention to you, Caid DeBarter, or did you hear
it? No, my word.
Okay.
All right. And that last sentence, he threw a little Sicilian in, which he's liked to do. He said, all right. Tuffy says to Joe, he said, all right, did you make any mention to you? And that's where you can't understand the words, Caidro Parte, that he is leaving. Or did you hear? And he said, no, not a word. See, they knew that Tuffy was leaving at this point in time. They knew he could not hang on the government, the casino, the feds.
Not Tuffy was, but Lefty Rosenthal.
Lefty Rosenthal. He was on his way out. That's what Tuffy meant, that Lefty's on his way out anyhow. So that's just a little example. That's pretty good audio, isn't it, Aaron?
That was good. That was a phone tap?
That was a phone tap. The phone taps are really good. It's a hidden microphones, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. This guy we're talking about tonight handles the installation of hidden microphones, and he handled them all here in Kansas City during this investigation. But that's a little example of what you'll find in the book. You know, another thing, I think we ought to get to know our fans, let them get to know us a little more. Now, fun facts. I came up with a fun fact about me. I learned this from another podcast advisor podcast that I listen to. Fun fact about me, during the last couple years I was on the Kansas City Police Department, I studied Spanish with a private teacher on the west side. I met her over at the library at the Irene Riaz Library, and I took private lessons for $10 an hour at her house. About twice a week I'd go over there for a while, and then I went down to Mexico, and I lived with a Mexican family, first in Cuernavaca for a week, and then I did another one for 2 weeks up in San Miguel de Allende, and took Spanish language classes all morning, and I just goofed around the afternoon. Now I can say, yo puedo hablar español con acento hillbilly. Now, after I did all this, it's still hard to speak Spanish, and I can't speak it with any kind of an accent. I was at the station one day when I still was working as a desk sergeant there just before I retired, and everybody knew I was trying to learn Spanish, and I'd practice on them sometimes, and somebody said, you know, you speak Spanish, but you speak it with a hillbilly accent. So that's a fun fact about me. What about you, Aaron? You got any fun fact about yourself?
I don't know, a fun fact about myself, maybe that, you know, I do stand-up comedy.
You know, I was thinking, when I was thinking about doing this, I thought, you know, folks don't know that you do stand-up comedy.
I do.
And we never talk about that, no. So.
And I don't seem so funny when I'm here on the program.
But. Well, sometimes you're pretty funny. Tell us a joke.
Oh, no.
That's probably as soon as you tell somebody, they say, well, tell me a joke. Perform.
Yeah. No, the other one would be, here's one you can use in your act.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, they tell you a joke to use in your act.
Yeah, when they see me after they see me on stage.
Interesting. That's like having a film, a documentary film. People, the first thing they'll say is, well, here's an idea. You need to do a film about this. So a filmmaker told me, he said, yeah, he said that whenever somebody says that, just say, yeah, give me $25,000 and we'll make that film.
I don't know if it works the same way with jokes. You know, like you can use this in your act.
I'm sure you're kind let them down easy and say, yeah, that's a good idea. You just, they notice that you don't make note of it. You don't write it down.
You just kind of have that awkward, uncomfortable laugh. And you're like, that was fun.
There you go. All right.
I'm a critic, but I'd have to say that if there was a fun fact, in the fall of 1996, I was the road manager and performed stand-up comedy on a college tour. And we did 54 colleges in 90 days, including the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City on Manhattan Island.
Oh, cool. That would have been a cool crowd.
The day that they had the parade for the Yankees when they won the World Series.
Oh, really? You were there?
Yeah, we got parking. It was amazing.
It was amazing. You had parking. Think about what our parade was like last year.
And, you know, we did the Culinary Institute up in Hyde Park, a lot of the SUNYs.
Oh, yeah.
Up in
New York. Yeah, that's a big one, isn't it? That is the Culinary Institute. That is the Harvard of Culinary Institutes.
Culinary Institutes. Yeah. So that was a great semester.
Cool. All right. Well, we're going to get into this story in just a minute. Don't forget to like my Gangland Wire Facebook page. I've got a new thing I'm doing. You get the True Crime Song of the Week each week. I got my son, who's kind of a music expert, and he's made up a whole list of YouTube videos of true crime songs. And so this week it's Drive, She Said, by Stan Ridgway, which is kind of a fun little true crime song. Just go to YouTube and actually go to my website, my Gangland Wire Facebook page, and you'll be able to find it if you do it pretty quick.
Well, of course, follow Gangland Wire on Twitter.
Yeah, at Jinx Law. And I probably will, I'll start tweeting these too. I didn't do that because I tweet something and I think it automatically goes to Gangland Wire. Or I'll do both. I need to do both because it's kind of a fun thing to do. I'm trying to do I did do that today and I put up a contest. You could click and I'll see which one wins if I get any clicks on. Between Hurricane and by Bob Dylan, and I Fought the Law, and the Law Won by the Bobby Fuller Four.
I don't know that.
Oh, I thought you had. I thought you were getting ready to say it.
Nope.
I didn't know it till I read that. Although as soon as I heard it, I knew it.
I was looking in the show notes.
I didn't put it in the show notes. I fooled you. All right, we need to get on with this story. We're going to tell a story about an FBI agent that went bad. You know, they have quite a reputation. You very seldom hear. You're always hearing about policemen getting caught stealing or killing somebody. We had the two mafia cops out of New York, if you remember. They were going around doing hits for the mob in New York. And God, I'm getting all this. There's a Chicago Outfit Facebook page. There's a couple, three of them. And this one guy puts up a lot of the articles from the Chicago Tribune. They have really covered organized crime over the years, especially during the 70s and 80s when they were probably at their peak, kind of like the Kansas City mob. They were at their peak in the 70s and 80s and came down after the Las Vegas skim investigation put all the heads of the families in jail. But man, there was cops, there was cops being executed. There's cops getting caught doing stuff. And they were, you know, part of the mob. They were part of the outfit up there. It's unbelievable. Tonight, we got an FBI agent that went bad. Well, he didn't join the mob. He had his own little action going on. In the 1970s, Ed Tickle was there, the FBI expert on what they called NDE. That's capital N is in Nora, D is in David, E is in Edward. And that's non-destructive entry, which really means is a nice word to say he sneaks into your house or sneaks into your office and makes surreptitious entries inside.
He knows how to pick locks.
He can pick locks. He can do. He has another thing, though. You don't always want to pick the lock, and maybe you can't always pick the lock. But maybe you want to get a key to use, and you go back in some other time. You might have a key, then you can go back in and take all the stuff out, and they never know where you put it.
How do you get a key?
Well, that's, he could do it. I'll tell you how. I'm going to tell you how. And he made entries inside the country in mob bosses' houses, businesses, cocaine dealers' houses and businesses, all kinds of Russian spy houses and safe houses that they could find. And he also did them outside the country. There's one story that's pretty prominent among FBI circles that he was, after the Iranian hostage crisis, after the hostages were all taken out of the embassy, and it was just kind of sitting there vacant for a while. It was all locked up, but it was vacant. I understand in modern times they made it into some kind of a site, a museum or something. But there's one story that he was sent over to Tehran to break into that embassy to retrieve some hidden documents. After, this was clear after the hostages were even released and it was still there. He was a legend, man. He was a legend in the Bureau. Like Aaron just mentioned, he was an expert lockpicker. But there's sometimes the Bureau wants to have their own key because you may have to go back in. Or maybe, I don't know, if you pick a lock, it can leave little, impressions and somebody that really pays attention to what's going on your lock. You can see some little scratches around the tumblers. He did something
Now, is that an indication that maybe your lock has been picked or?
Well, it could be, yeah, because you take those picks and you poke around at the lock.
And you can move the tumblers into position.
The tumblers, and so as you've got the torsion bar, which slides in and keeps pressure on. It's a flat bar that slides in the bottom where the bottom part of the key is, and it just keeps pressure on the lock. It's like it's ready to turn at any time. And then you take the other pick, and you go in and you try to push the pins down that you need to push down. And as you get the last pin pushed down, you got the tension. The torsion bar keeps the tension on the lock, and then it'll go ahead and open. But he did something called impressioning. Now, there's two ways to impression a key. There's the way that we all know. You maybe take a key, you steal somebody's key. For example, you have your house key or your business keys or all your keys on your key ring, and you have your car taken into the car repair place. Or you have your car at a car valet place, and you have to leave your keys. Well, if you're following a guy around, you can find those keys and then take some clay or some wax and make an impression of the key. And then from that impression, you can go create a mold and make your own key, an exact duplicate. There's another way that you do it. It's kind of the reverse way. It's called manipulation-based impressioning. And he was an expert, nationally known expert in this technique. He was even the people in the private business that were, in the locksmith business were impressed with him on this. He finds the target lock. He takes a picture of it. And so he finds out exactly what kinds it is. And then he goes and gets a blank that will fit, a blank that's for that kind of, if it's a Schlegel lock, then you take a Schlegel blank.
And he identifies the manufacturer.
Manufacturer of the lock. Right. And you get a blank that's just for that kind of lock. So you know it's the right kind of lock. Now you got to get it cut to where it will depress the tumblers or the pins as it turns, and then it unlocks the lock. And I can't explain exactly. I'm not explaining this very well, but it's got these pins in there that, the jagged edge of the key then depresses these pins to a certain distance. And then once they're all depressed at a certain distance at the same time, it unlocks and turns and opens the lock.
Well, when you cut the key, the key corresponds to the various tumblers in the lock, and they're set at different heights.
Right.
And part of the difference in the keys is that on the side where they're kind of edged,
yeah,
or grooved along the edges where you, if you don't have the right key, it won't fit into the lock because of those.
Right.
So he identifies the manufacturer. Obviously, then they're not going to say, well, we can't give you a blank key.
Well, is it FBI? Yeah. And any locksmith would be able to get a blank key. They have certain blank keys that locksmith won't sell you unless you're another locksmith.
Like a master key.
Well, I mean, it's not even a master key. It's just the right length and width that will fit into that lock.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a blank that would fit into that particular lock. So I don't understand how he works this, but they make another blank from that blank that is some kind of maybe softer material. Then he goes to the lock, he sticks it in, and he manipulates it and jiggles it a little bit until he gets an impression of the pin location, and somehow he figures out what the depth is, how far each pin has to be depressed. And then he withdraws the blank, and there's these little tiny impressions where the lock pin locations are. He has to maybe use an ultraviolet light or put it under a microscope, and then he grinds out the key and makes the exact key to fit that without ever having the key, without ever taking the lock apart. He can do it pretty quickly. He was doing it. He would even, for example, you need to do this maybe on the front door.
Mm-hmm.
So one time twice he did this. One time it was because there was a big guard dog inside the yard, they used a refrigerator box. And they just slid the refrigerator box right up by the front door. And then he had a little tiny hole, like about 6x6, right about where the lock was. And then he just stuck his hands out and used the blank key and did the manipulation-based impressioning, and then they came back and got the box and moved it off, and
the guard dog never barked?
Yeah, well, he probably ran up and barked, but then it was nothing but a box, and so he, you know, I don't know. I wasn't there. But,
no one looked out the window. Why is there a refrigerator box out front of the house now?
I think it's probably 3
in the morning.
Yeah, I think probably there wasn't anybody home when they did this. It was more to hide him from passerbys in a highly traveled area. Or it's probably a business.
Random refrigerator box sitting in front of the house.
Yeah, and it
right at the doorstep.
Yeah, really.
Locking the front door.
Honey, did you order a new refrigerator?
Yeah.
No, I didn't. Well, we got one out there. Yeah, that would anyhow.
But so, finding how each individual pin has to be set just a certain height.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how that works, how he knows how deep that it goes, but somehow that blank can tell you, and he can stick it in there, manipulate it, and then pull it back out and look at it under a microscope and figure out the exact...
The location of the pins.
Location and depth. So, you know, how a key is jagged and made.
Yeah, that's the part where I would think it would be difficult to figure out how far the pins need to be depressed.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't explain it.
You're actually going to release the lock.
Yeah, that one was... I read up on it, and nothing I could find was explaining that one to me.
You were doing Google searches on picking locks?
Doing Google searching on picking locks. Yes, I was. I hope Big Brother's not out there watching me.
Now, I know I've been doing a lot of Google searching lately on hijacking.
Hijacking, skyjacking. That's like my friend Paul Sharp, who was on the show not too long ago. He's getting ready to... He left one job, and he was putting himself back out on the market. And, you know, any more people do a lot of social media searching whenever you're trying to get a job. Mm-hmm. Well, Paul has all these pictures of friends of his who are mob guys that have written books, and he got connected up with out at the MobCon. There's that... Frank Calabrese Jr. and Frank Culotta, both of whom were real deal killers in the mob and have gone the witness protection program and then come back out and written books. So he put me down as a policeman as one of his references. So he'd always like tell them, you know, so here's the deal and you can call this guy. Probably has some pictures of me with some of them.
And you're like, yeah, he was a mobster.
He was, yeah, Paul Sharp, mobster. No, not hardly. He's our good friend, and actually he was victimized horribly by the mob up in Chicago, and they killed his father or a mob associate killed his father for really no good reason other than ego, because he was a nutcase, I guess. But back to Ed Tickle. In Kansas City, we had three well-known microphone installations, and one was at the Villa Capri. The other one was at the law office of John Patrick Quinn. The third was inside the house of Josephine Marlowe. Now, the first one, the Villa Capri, was pretty easy. I understand from talking to the guys that he did come to town, but what he did, I think he picked that lock. It was been an older lock, and they didn't have very good security.
On the front door of the Villa Capri.
The front door. They took a female agent. I actually didn't have agents probably at that point in time in 1976. Or they didn't have many. They probably had a clerk. And so he walks around to the front. They did this twice at the John Patrick Quinn, the Quinn and People's Law Office downtown. They went by on a Sunday morning when nobody was at the law office. And the other one was late at night. And he just acted like he was making out the woman and with the woman as they stood in front of the door. And then his hands were around her back, blocked from anybody driving by. And he just picked the lock, I understand, on both of those. Now, the other one was a little more creative. That was the...
No, wait, that was just to get inside the Villa Capri. Then, I mean, when you're planting a microphone, and you're not talking about like a wireless microphone like
no,
in 2016. You're talking about 1976.
Right, and they didn't really have very good... They had a few wireless mics, but they weren't very good. Now, they had to go to a phone line. They figure out, you know, they already know the color of the walls. They know the consistency of the walls and the material on the walls. If it's plaster, these were probably plaster in a lot of the walls. They knew they were white or pink or whatever, so they'd already gotten paint and plaster if they wanted to put it in the walls, or maybe they hide it up underneath the table or in the seat, hide it in the seat, and they figure out before they make survey, they'd go in and they make a survey of these places. And figure out the best place to do that.
Casually stroll in. And...
Yeah, they've already been in there several times, gone in there and had pizza or whatever. And the law offices were a little bit harder. I know in the law office.
Set up like an appointment?
No, they knew the room that they were always sitting around talking in and the phone that they used. But because here's what they did there. They knew they were going inside most every afternoon. They got a double-decker bus. They rented a double-decker bus somewhere, and they put it in the parking lot right next to the second-floor law office. And they got up on the upper level of the bus and then watched inside the windows. And they saw that they were all inside this particular office. So that was the office of John Patrick Quinn, the main lawyer there, and who was Nick's lawyer. So they knew that they were meeting in that particular room. And it was just kind of a small room. And they had, it was a Sunday, and they had most all day to do this.
So in the instance of that, with the law office, they were tapping the phone.
And planting the bug, too.
And planting bugs, too.
Right.
And then there was the microphones, much like with the Villa Capri, then they had to... You know, under the table, they kind of knew where they would meet at the back of the Villa Capri.
Yeah.
So they could place the mic and they had to run a wire.
Yeah, in the Villa Capri, they ran it down the wall, down in the basement, and then out through
the sidewall. They put it underneath the table. You kind of hope that they don't move the table.
Yeah, really. Yeah, everyone's different, and sometimes things do happen, but they just do the best job they can. Yeah, don't move the table. You know, and like it was a banquette, and more than likely the banquette was fixed to the wall.
Banquette. And then, well, what's a banquette?
You know, it's like the seats that are up against the wall, okay. And then they have a table, and then they have chairs on the other side. They were affixed to the wall. The seats were, and I'm not sure about the tables were or not at the.
But that's in the back of the Villa Capri. That's where they put the microphone.
And yes.
How did they scout the basement to know where to be able to?
Well, you have to do that night. Probably didn't get in the basement before. Same way in the law office. I don't know exactly what they did there, but it probably ran it right straight outside to the wall and then just ran a wire up. You know, it was an old building downtown, second floor of a two-story building downtown.
Because it's the FBI, probably get electrical plans and anything like that.
Yeah.
From contractors without anybody revealing that fact.
If you've got, you know, if you can find that, you can find who's got that. You may be able to get that. There may be some stuff down at the city. You just start, you know, seeing what kind of public sources you can use to kinds of things.
Well, you still had to get a warrant from a judge, didn't you, to place the mics?
Yeah, you have to have probable cause to say this is who was going to talk. Inside this place, this is what we think they're going to say, and this is why we think it's what they're talking about is part of an illegal conspiracy. And this is the sources that we use to learn that, like at the the Villa Capri, Villa Capri, they had two or three sources that told about having conversations at this one particular table with Nick Civella, Carl Civella, Tuffy DeLuna, and other mob guys. And so, you know, all right, we've got two different sources. You have agents and Kansas City Police intelligence officers that had documented them being down there and had been inside the joint and seen them sitting at that table. They'd never seen anybody else but these mob guys sitting at the table, and they'd seen Tuffy and Corky and all of them sitting there many times over the last several years. This was like their regular headquarters.
Yeah. It was their social club.
Their social club, in a way. They had another social club, but this was their late night social club, and they felt safe in there and comfortable because they knew the owner, and he was kind of a half-ass mob guy himself, Rossi Estrada. So they felt safe in there, and they really felt safe in the – they didn't talk that much in there, and it was hard to hear. They really felt safe at the lawyer's office, though. That's what's so funny. I mean, I got the best conversations. You just can't believe the conversations you get.
At the lawyer's office.
At the lawyer's office. And, well, and they were good.
Well, at the Capri, there's also a lot of background noise. Jukebox, you would say. Yeah. And then at the lawyer's office, they're in a room. There's no other background noise.
It's quiet. Yeah. Those were really high quality recordings that we got out of the lawyer's office. Buy my book and you'll get to hear a bunch of them.
Or buy the DVD.
There's a few of them in Gangland Wire. I don't think I really go in. Yeah, I do go into... the fact we had it in the lawyer's office in the DVD. So
you interviewed some people from the lawyer's office, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. One of the lawyers and then one of the gals who was a paralegal. And it was funny. She said she had met Nick Civella and he's just the nicest guy in the world. She had no idea who he was. And he just knew he was this really nice, gentlemanly old man. So let me tell you about the third one. This guy, Ed Tickle, he was known to be creative. And we had Bill Owsley described this as putting a microphone in the lion's den, so to speak, because they knew they had been telegraphing for a couple, 3 weeks. There's going to be a big meeting to talk about skimming from the casinos with two of their casino moles. That one of them we heard from earlier, Joe Augusto, and his coworker, Carl Thomas. And they were going to come to Kansas City on this particular weekend and meet in this house with Carl Civella, Corky, Nick Civella, the boss, and Tuffy DeLuna, the underboss. They had all these elaborate plans that they talked about over the phones before that on how they were going to get them there and the different subterfuges they take. It's fascinating. It's a whole study in how the mob works.
Just this is also
going over those wiretaps. Oh, yeah, that'll be in the book.
But this location was the house of Josephine Marlowe.
Yeah, which was Nick Civella's sister-in-law. She lived about a half a block from Nick Civella. See, where they live, and this is all in the Mob Tour app, it's a two block by one block neighborhood, and many of the houses are connected by a 6 foot high privacy fence, so they form a communal backyard. So they wanted to use Josephine Marlowe's house because they needed to use a house that they could sneak into. Well, how they could sneak into it, we would pick these guys up at the airport, put them in a car, and they would drive down to one of the Civella brothers' houses. Tony Ripe, he was in the penitentiary down in Texas at this point in time. But they could drive right into his garage. So they'd open up the door in his garage, and they'd drive right in. Then they'd go out into his house and then walk out the back door and then walk across the backyards hidden by the privacy fence and enter the back door of the Josephine Marlowe house. So they really wanted to keep, this really was a secret meeting. Now they needed to get a listening device inside that house. I've talked to one guy who was involved with this.
And it's a private residence.
It's a private residence.
You would think that Josephine Marlowe would be suspicious no matter what.
Well, somewhat, yeah. She lived up there and she's a relative of Nick Civella. She's an older lady and she's lived this life. So she's not going to be cooperative. She's not a criminal. She's not going to be uncooperative. She's just not going to be cooperative. And, of course, you can't come to her and say, you know, we'd like to plant a microphone in your house, and we need you to help the FBI here. She's not going to do that. First of all, she's going to say no. And then next of all, she's going to march right over to her sister's house and Catherine Civella and tell her. And then she's going to tell her husband, Nick, and, you know, the jig is up, shall we say. So this Ed Tickle and a local agent who is a black bad guy himself, who is kind of a, he's interesting. He's a kind of a cherubic faced guy. You would never pick him out as the guy that goes around breaking into houses and planting microphones and doing things like that. Nice guy. So, and Ed Tickle was the same way. He was not big, tough, strong, you know, athletic looking guy. He's kind of a small, you know, cherubic faced little guy. They come up with a plan. The first thing they do is they mess up the phone. They go, the Josephine Marlowe, all of a sudden, she has reported it, and they've told the phone company they have a good contact in the phone company security, and he, you know, takes that service call and gives it the FBI, and they already have their Southwestern Bell telephone company at the time. They already have their Southwestern Bell vest and a Southwestern Bell truck, and so they appear to fix the phone. She welcomes them in, and they split. There's two of them, so they split up. And one of them takes the phone in the kitchen, and the other one just kind of starts milling around the house. And, well, do you have any other phones in here? Let me show me where they are. And so she goes with, Ed Tickle was at the phone in the kitchen, and he installs a hidden microphone inside the phone. You know, they had a hidden microphone that you can put inside the phone and then turn it on and off remotely, which is kind of cutting-edge technology back then. But they could see it probably, the kitchen wasn't big enough to have any kind of a meeting of four and five people. And there was a family room right off the kitchen. And you know, it was big enough and had a nice, comfortable living room set and TV and coffee table and all that. And they figured that was going to be where the meeting was. Now, you know, Bill Owsley told us about another situation like this, and you couldn't put a microphone in a bedroom or a bathroom at this point in time, and they met in the bedroom. They were supposed to, you would have thought they would meet in the living room or the family room, and they didn't. They met in the bedroom. They didn't get a thing.
Maybe that was because they already knew.
Somebody,
they
don't
knew
know.
The rules that you had to play by, and so yeah, they used those to their advantage.
They did. Obviously, Nick Civella did not think of that in this situation, because they ended up meeting in this family room that was bugged.
Wait, so if we talk a little bit about the phone bug that they put in, do you know anything about it specifically?
No, I don't. Technically, I can't tell you any more about it. I just know there is a device
when they hang up the phone, normally that disconnects the...
Right, but you can then open it back up remotely and listen. That's been around for years. I don't know how it works. I'm no technical guy.
If you took the phone apart, you wouldn't necessarily know.
You probably would find it if you knew anything about phones. I mean, if you knew what looked funny in there. I never did any of this kind of work. I just know these kinds of things exist. I don't know how they work. So they, Tony's walking around in the house because he's really what he's doing. He's saying he wants to check the other phones, but he's really doing a survey of the house. And she's walking along with him. They strike up a conversation, and he actually finds out her secret for making chili, because she was making chili when they came in. And the secret of making chili in the Marlowe residence is to add a little cumin to the normal chili recipe. Tony said he went home and tried that, and it worked, and it was really good chili. So they get all done there, but they know now they need to get back in the house and put the hidden microphone in. They come up with this idea. They get a car exactly like Josephine Marlowe's car. They get a garage door opener that will open her garage door. You know, garage doors work with a audio signal, not audio, work with a signal that goes through the air on a certain frequency, and there's a pretty limited amount of frequencies, and I think they had a device that would tell you. You could be sitting outside her house or down the street from her house and watch her open her garage door, and it would pick up that frequency, and then you could make your own clone garage door opener.
Like a scanner,
yeah, kind of like a scanner. Or they might have caught her car away from the parked in a parking lot, followed her for a little bit and caught her car parked in a parking lot and broke into it and got the garage door opener out and figured out what the code was, the frequency was that garage door opened. Anyhow, they got a clone garage door opener. They got a car just like hers, and they knew, I suspect they might have listened on the phone. I don't know how this works exactly technically. They keep some things, they plan pretty close to their vest, but they may have already be listening on her phone to get information only, not for prosecution, but only to allow them to enter the house. And they found out she was leaving a particular time. They get set up the car, and just like hers, They get a woman that wears a wig that looks like her, and they get the agents, and they lay down the back seat, and the trunk's filled with their equipment. As soon as she drives out of the neighborhood, the surveillance crew picks her up and follows her away to make sure they let them know if she starts coming back home. And they drive into the neighborhood, hit the garage door opener, and looks like her car going in the garage door, and shut the garage door behind them. They get out, and they've got plenty of time, and they plan. I think he told me they had a particular piece of wood that was part of the bracing of the couch, and they put the microphone there. And then, again, you hope, as Aaron said, hope you don't move the couch, because they had to drill a hole in the floor and go down the basement and then run the wire out to the
outside,
the phone line.
That was actually how they got connected. I just changed mic channels here because it seemed like I wasn't getting a good audio. But it always seems to be, people think today, and, as you would listen to this, that the technology of today, but this wasn't. This was, 1976.
Yeah.
It was pretty, analog at that point. So your ability to, field recordings from a microphone to capture it in your remote to the location. I mean, you're not putting a reel-to-reel tape recorder in their basement.
No.
You have to somehow be able to punch down on their phone line. And since they'd already been through there, I would imagine when they came in as the repairman for AT&T. Southwestern Bell. That not only would they look at the phone itself, but they go, well, let's see where it connects to the wall and maybe where it terminates. Because right. There's usually a point where it's going to leave the house.
Yeah, they
might. So they would be able to kind of site survey that as well to figure out how they would going to place a microphone anyway. Cause,
right. Yeah, it's pretty technical stuff, but they did it, and the rest is history, shall we say. That's that 4 or 5 hours of audio tape is what put the Midwest mob guys in the penitentiary for the rest of their lives. All the bosses irrevocably changed the mafia in the Midwest. Okay, folks, now that's probably enough for this is what I know about Ed Tickle before we learned about his secret life as a burglar. So why don't we end this one today, and we will come back with a second episode.
Did you work directly with Ed Tickle anytime during this period when you were kind of working intelligence and he was in there doing work? You didn't have to help move a refrigerator box or?
No, I didn't. What the local police, what our job always was, because these were secret, super secret deals. They only told a few people. And what our job would have been, and usually it was the sergeants that did this, they would put on a uniform and get a check out of marked car. And when they're making an installation, they just go out and drive around the neighborhood and maybe sit across the street or sit down the street a little ways, act like they're writing a report or something, and just sit there just in case something happened. Then they come storming in and everybody, nobody will challenge a uniformed policeman in a deal like that.
But if it's just some guy who's, in a jumpsuit, like,
Everybody be calling the police on him.
Yeah, I mean, because now they're in the house. They plant the bugs, or they do the wires for the microphones. Then they got to back out of the driveway and leave.
Yeah.
How much longer till after Josephine Marlowe showed back up? Do you know?
Yeah, I have no idea. They were long gone when she showed back up. So let's wind this down. Aaron, why don't you tell people just a little bit about the Big Dumb Fun Show? We haven't talked about that for a while.
Well, the Big Dumb Fun Show is a drive time style trending talk independent unsigned music radio TV program online at bigdumbfunshow.com. We broadcast live on Mondays from 7 to 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. Episodes are available for download. Go to bigdumbfunshow.podbean.com.
All right. Good night, folks. Say good night, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.